Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Hey guys, welcome back to Magic TV. My name's Craig. It is 9 o'clock and it is time for a Talk Magic. And I'm here with somebody I have so much respect for, and we'll get into it why, but he is an absolute living legend in the magic community, especially in the UK. Mr. Prop Dog himself, Dave Bonsall. How you doing, Dave?
Yeah, that is the best intro I've ever had in my entire life. Woo!
Oh, thanks, man. And I'm so excited that we're doing this interview and you are right there where the Prop Dog Facebook and YouTube live show is.
Where the live show happens. This is it.
It's the best show on the internet. I'm calling it right now. It is the best show on the internet. And I want to talk all about Prop Dog. But first of all, I think a lot of the people that are on this channel, they're newer magicians.
Yeah.
Maybe in the last 5 years, they've got into magic. So I think a lot of people just know you from Prop Dog.
Yeah.
But you did a hell of a lot more before Prop Dog even existed. And I want to start off at the very, very beginning, if I can. So what was your origin story? How did you get into magic, if you don't mind me asking?
A hell of a lot more happened before Prop Dog started, before I even started magic. I was one of these kids with a magic set. And I had it was one of the Paul Daniels magic sets on it. And I'm one of these kids that I always tried to seek out praise, and I wanted people to like me. You know, I had a really tough childhood growing up, school to school, very bullied, parents, really rocky relationship with the parents. My stepdad used to hit me around a lot. So I was always seeking attention of some kind, and magic was a great way of doing that. So when I first got a magic set, you know, I knew a few people, did a few tricks, a few friends of the family, and I was always really excited with that. And I thought, you know, I can do that too. So when I got a first magic set, of course, I played with a few things and went and showed my mum and dad, said, "Look, mum, look at this." And they were like, "Yes, dear, that's lovely. Yeah, yes, run along and play." And I was like, where's this, you know, this praise? Where's this, like, oh, you're wonderful, gone? And I thought, right, obviously I'm not doing it right. I need to work harder at this. And I kind of figured out that people could see what I was doing and I wasn't doing this right. So that was it. I just started practicing really hard. And I had the little plastic cups and balls, a little furry ball in it. And I did a load of stuff from the routine. I just practiced it solidly from this box for about, oh, I can't remember. It seems like years back then, but it was probably like a week or something. But then I went and showed my mum one of the tricks. I can't remember which one it was. But all I remember is her going, "Yes, dear." That's like, what? Oh, Peter called my dad. It was just, do that one again. And that was it. For me, that was my first moment of, oh my God, someone's given me, you know, some feedback. I'm special for those few minutes. And that was it. I was kind of hooked. And from that moment onwards, I learned that if I just quickly did something, people were going to, you know, fob me off. But if I learned it properly, you know, did it really, really well, then, you know, I got the attention. And that's how it all started. So it went on from there. I remember when I went to school, I used to have, of course, I'd had no access to magic books or TV or anything. You know, the Paul Daniels magic show was on. I'd pause things, but couldn't really learn that much from it. But I remember going to school with a piece of elastic taped up here, down my sleeve, up to there with a little safety pin on. And the end of the safety pin was this little rag, this dirty little rag about that big. And I would have this thing where I'd go, watch, it's gone. And that was my thing at school. People knew me for that. And I got attention for that at school. And it just kind of went on from there. And then, you know, the first days going to Davenport's, you know, the first ever trip to a magic shop. And it was like, oh my God, this is amazing. You know, it was a little hallelujah moment. And that was it. I became a kind of a hobby magician. And that carried on through school. It was a great way to meet, you know, girls, keep the bullies at bay. Then later on, I went to join the Marines, and, you know, my kind of level went up. You know, I was never amazing, but I was quite a competent hobbyist when I joined the Marines. And again, you're in a group of alpha males, and it's a great way to kind of communicate and interact with them. But more importantly, these group of testosterone-fueled Marines that have been locked up on a camp for 4 or 5 weeks to get away for a weekend, you're suddenly allowed out, and there's these girls. Of course, it's Dave, come here, go to those girls, show them some magic, get them over. And I was the go-to guy. You know, I'd quite often go up to the group of people, do some magic, and then bring them back in, and off we go. So yeah, I kind of went there, and it was just a way of you know, being cool, but also doing what I love. I just love the feedback, that interaction, that, oh, you're great, you know, and it is like a drug and you feed off it. Unfortunately, it goes to so many people's heads a little bit too much, but that was my kind of starting to magic. And I've been through everything. I've been through Dove Acts, Escapology Acts, Stage Acts, Manipulation, and eventually found my footing in close-up. So, yeah.
And here's a question for you. Yeah. So you're in the Marines, you went through school, you're in the Marines, mm-hmm. and you're still doing magic. Did you find it back then hard to practice and at the same time, because obviously being a Marine is a very, because it comes up on the channel a lot. Oh, I don't have time to practice. I love magic, but I'm too busy after being at work all day and family and kids. And I can't think of anything more like mentally and physically, tiring than being a Marine. And
yeah, I practiced very, very little. I mean, at first, I was really embarrassed about doing anything because I didn't want to be like, oh, look at that nerd, you know, this group of men. But, you know, when the opportunity came to do the first one, I saw the reactions, that was it, I was hooked. But don't get me wrong, at this stage here, I wasn't like, I'm going to go away and practice, you know, for hours and end. I wasn't that good, you know. I was a competent hobbyist who knew probably 15, 20 odd tricks. I did kind of fairly well. And most of those are just simple forcing of cards. It was only after that, much later on, that my level went from hobbyist to, you know, up where I was. And that was, that's another long story. I mean, if you've listened to my Magician's podcast one some time ago, you'll hear the whole story. But, you know, I could go on a good half an hour, 40 minutes about how all that came around. But I could tell you, I could jump to certain parts, but it wouldn't make so much sense if you hadn't heard of the earlier parts. So it depends whether you want to go into it or not. I'm happy to go into it.
Yeah, I mean, it's up to you. I mean, obviously, people can check that out on the podcast. If you want to go into it now, that's fine.
I do a short one, basically. So the short end of it is all, I was in a situation where I was in hospital. I had major back surgery. I was told I could no longer be a Marine. I didn't know where my career was going to go. I'd only ever been a lifeguard and a Marine, so I could, you know, save people's lives or kill them. And it was like, where do I go from here? And I needed an outlet. And knowing that I'd probably never be able to do sport again, I had to find something I could do for the rest of my life. And that's when it kind of popped into my head. I mean, there's a lot more in depth of the story, and it's very much a lot of highs and lows and, you know, some really low points in my life that magic kind of got me out of. But there was a time when I said, right, I'm going to be a professional magician. Lying in a hospital bed, that was my decision. I'm going to be a professional magician. That's going to be my life from now onwards. And that was it. And then 3 or 4 years later, you know, I was out top of my game working all over the country. So, yeah.
And that's the thing that I want to talk to you about. You say, oh, I was a professional close-up magician, but you were at the very, very top of the, you know, you were in the top tier of close-up magicians in the whole of the UK. You were the guy, when I first got into magic, everybody was talking about, oh, Dave Bonsall, and you appeared everywhere. When people were looking for a magician, it was like, it was Dave Bonsall. So yeah. you didn't just decide, oh, I'm going to be a magician. You dominated that industry. You really did.
I wouldn't say dominated. I was amongst a handful. I mean, there was a lot of us back at the time who were up there. You had obviously Etienne, you had the Rob James, you had Alan Hudson, myself, David Redfern, Jamie and Paul. We're all kind of in that elite group together. You know, there was probably 15, 20 of us, I would say, that I was aware of anyway, that were right up there. But there's a lot of people, you know, were up there that you maybe not heard of. They don't socialize so much with magicians, but yeah. For me, it was a case of when I decided that I was going to be a professional magician, it had to be no longer a hobbyist. This is a career, and I had to treat it like a career. You know, it's show business, and I had to treat it like a business. So when I started learning magic, I wasn't just learning magic. I was learning business. I was learning everything from the sales side, the marketing side. I learned so much on, you know, my library was kind of books on conversational reframing, you know, how to win friends and influence people, sell to win, you know, the power of marketing. All these kind of books went into it, and I studied as much into the business as I did the performance side. And I very much realized that if I want to work at this, there's no point learning 1,000 tricks, you know, that's for the hobbyist. For as a worker, I've got to learn a set amount of tricks. When I perform, I will be performing the same tricks to thousands of people, whereas a hobbyist will perform thousands of tricks to the same people. So there was no point saying, right, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. For me, it was like, what do I want to know? List the tricks, master those. While I'm mastering those, study the business, study the marketing, study, you know, comedy on TV, study business, study everything I can to do with that, and let's make this a business. And that's pretty much what I did. And yeah, once I realized what I wanted to do, it was a case of, right, these are the tricks I want. Will it work? So go out and work that as much as possible, free of charge. I'd just go out to residencies. If I couldn't get paid for it, I'd say, well, I'll do it free of charge and we'll see how we go. And I'd end up spending 6 months doing it free, because for me, it was a way of working the tricks, finding out what works. And those 10 tricks I started with, all of those stayed in, because it was like, whichever one gets the worst reaction over like a 2 month period, that one goes out, something else comes in, see how that gets on. And only the ones with the best reactions, that top sort of segment, stayed in. The rest of it got thrown out. And that was how the career developed, really, and the act, I guess.
And would you say that's the biggest piece of it? But for somebody who's new, as I mean, obviously, let's just assume that the apocalypse ends at some point. For somebody who's new into magic as a close-up magician and wanting to make a career for themselves, would you say that's the biggest piece of advice you can give them? Treat it like a business?
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are so many people out there who are brilliant magicians. I mean, absolutely brilliant. But they've just never made it, or no one's ever heard of them. They just don't get it because they're not inclined that way. They're not interested in learning stuff outside magic. You know, they're like, I want to get paid for my hobby. But you've got to forget that. You know, it can't be a hobby anymore. It's a business now. Put the hobby stuff aside. You know, you're working for a business. And I would say spend, well, the early days, you've got to master your act. But once you've mastered that act, there's no point practicing on your own at home, because you're just doing the same thing. If you're going to practice, go out and practice outside with real people, because that's how your act develops. Once you've got, so here's an example. I once had a principle that I would do a trick in front of a mirror or camera, and if I got it right, I'd take a jar, okay, with 100 marbles in, I'd take one marble out and I'll put it in another jar, okay, and when I got it right, and I'll keep on doing that. And if a trick went wrong, empty the marbles back out and start all over again, okay, and I would do that until I get 100 in, perfect, and then I'd go out and work it. But then after a while, you realize that that's okay for mastering the trick, but there's so much more to a trick than just sitting there performing it and getting it the moves right. You know, the trick is an interaction between two people. So once I'd learned an effect and got it right, the practice of the trick stopped at home. All the practice then was about the business side. It was just constantly learn, and then go out, do a gig, free or not. And that's the practice then, because there's so much more to it than just showing off. You know, I don't sit there and go, hey, look how good I am. It's not. It's an interaction between you and me, you know. It's like, it doesn't matter how the trick gets to the ending, that's irrelevant. Whether you use a Svengali deck or the, you know, a clip shift or whatever, it's irrelevant. The end result is the reaction from the audience. So, like, I've spoke to people who have said, crazy man's handcuffs, sponge balls, why would you do that at a gig, you know, when you can do this? I'm like, well, it's not about me, it's about them. Okay, it's all about the reaction from the people. Doesn't matter how I get there. I'm an entertainer first and foremost. So as long as it's entertaining, I'll do any crap. Doesn't matter. I'll happily use a Svengali or a stripper deck if it gets me there. So yeah, the practice went out to the people. You know, I'd go out, I'd do a gig, and I'd do 3 or 4 hours sometimes at residency. That's my practice. Go home, wake up in the morning, into the books, read the books, read the marketing, learn about SEO, learn about Google AdWords, and go from there. I think one of the craziest things I ever did was decide to spend about £1,500 a month on Google AdWords. I mean, starting off, that was the scariest thing in the world. But the more I learned with business, the more I thought, well, speculate to accumulate. It's got to be worth it. And that £1,500 on AdWords will bring an extra £6,000 in bookings a week. And those are the kind of things I had to learn. I would never have known that if I was just practicing magic all day on my own.
And it amazes me how many magicians, you know, you're talking about speculate to accumulate. Magicians don't even know how much money they've got coming in, what their expenses are, what their turnover is, what their gross profit is. They don't know any of that. They're just like, oh yeah, I'll put that in my pocket, right? Let's move on to the next gig. You know, the days of putting an advert in the yellow pages and crossing your fingers and hoping that the phone rings.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the agency system. You know, I spoke to Etienne the other week, who ran an agency, and he said, well, he doesn't really do anything with it anymore because people don't want agencies. Those days are kind of over. You need to be able to market yourself if you're going to be successful. You just have to.
Back in the day, agencies were people who couldn't get the work anywhere else. I mean, I remember, you know, Yellow Pages, he said, it's like, what, how much for an advert in Yellow Pages? Oh my God, hang on. This is only Hampshire. What if I want Sussex, which is right next to us? Or if I want Dorset, right next to us, or London? then that's five or so yellow pages. How much money? It's ridiculous. But you had to do it back then, and you had to pay for everything you could. And agencies were a necessity because you didn't get the work. People didn't necessarily want to go look for the yellow pages to go for a magician. They wanted to just say, go to the agency, right, you provide the catering, the band, the magician, whatever. And that was easy. But yeah, nowadays they realize, well, if I just go on the internet, I can find everyone I need, and I can find somebody in half the time. Plus, I can choose who I want. So yeah, yellow pages quickly went defunct, but you still got to speculate to accumulate. And that was all part of it. Yeah, I spent a fortune back in the day. I mean, crazy, but it worked.
Yeah, exactly. And that's it at the end of the day. Now, yeah. One other thing I want to speak to you about that period of time, is you created a lot of magic back then, not to sell, that wasn't your thing,
yeah,
to do yourself. Like I've told people on this channel, one of the best, most commercial close-up routines that I do is your sugar routine.
Yeah,
it just kills. I don't go to a gig without making sure that I've got the sugar routine on.
Thank you.
It's brilliant. It really is. And obviously that is available through Prop Dog. You know, it's something that you can buy, but you didn't create that to sell it.
No,
you created it to put in your own act. So have you got any advice for people? And that's something that you did an awful lot. So have you got any advice for people that want to make their act unique and they want to create something that's not an off-the-shelf product? Or maybe they want to take an off-the-shelf product and they want to make it their own. That's something that I think you did a lot in your career as a performer. Do you have any advice on how you actually, you know, how you get inspiration to do that and the process you go through?
Yeah. Well, let's use the sugar routine as an example, okay? First of all, you want to put something new in your act, okay? And I think, right, what do I want to put new in the act? And I think, well, what's my environment I work in? I work at tables. I work around tables. So therefore, can I use what is organic on the table to do the magic? Because anything organic, if you were a real magician, you'd just say, oh, what's this? Gone. You know, you wouldn't go and come in and say, I've got this over here and open this and open that and do that and then make it vanish. You know, you just pick up something, you can make it go. So I thought, right, as much as I can, it's going to be organic items. So what's around the table? And that included what everyone is wearing or what is on the table, or maybe what's behind the table at the bar. You know, what can you get from the waiter or so on and so forth. So like the ring routine, for example, that came around because people were wearing rings and there's a lot of ring magic out there. I wasn't happy with it. It's not particularly original to me, but you know, I just kind of evolved my take on it. Now with the sugar routine, it was the same. I thought, right, what can I use around the table? What's on a table? And, you know, you list all the items. You list, you know, knife, fork, spoon, salt cellar, sugar bowl, coffee bowls, teacups, saucers, chairs, you know, clothing, tie, you know, wallet. What's in your wallet? What are they holding in the wallet? What are they holding in the pockets? What on the keys, the car keys, everything. And then you make a list of stuff and you start thinking about what can I do with that. So you think, well, let's get some inspiration. What's out there with those items? So I started looking around what's out there. And one of the things on my list was money. And I got the amazing Michael Amar series of the easy to master ones. And one of them is easy to master money miracle. So again, I bought all three of those. What's on there with money that I can use, or what's on there with something else on the table? And lo and behold, he had something with money and salt. I thought, bingo, money and salt. So here's a little routine. Take a banknote, pour it in with some salt, and it's gone, pour it out, back gone. Right, there's a start. So that's my inspiration. I'm going to use money and salt. Well, salt's been done before. What else is a sugar? Right, could I use sugar or salt? Well, if I use sugar, you got sugar cubes and you get sugar sachets and sticks. If you use salt, you get a salt cellar and you get the salt. Well, people have done salt coin and a salt cellar, or done vanishing salt cellars, but not many people have done stuff with sugar. There's somebody's done something with the sweet and low, I think. Let's make my own kind of version of that. So, right, how do we start off? You know, money, sugar goes in, sugar vanish. Okay, that's one. And that is a trick in its own, but we're going to take this further now. Well, what about when you pour the sugar out? Don't just pour it out, change it to a sugar cube. Pour it out. Here's find a way to do that. Okay, well, we've done the sugar cube. What now? And I did at one point have a little routine where I pick up a cocktail stick and I go, watch this with a sugar cube. And I go, boomf. And I do the whole penetration of a sugar cube. So I'll get all these sugar cubes. I drill a hole to them, glue a cocktail stick in. So I did this thing where I can give it away as a souvenir. And that was that. And I did it for a while. And it's like, well, it's tricky to make. And it's not really that impressive. But more importantly, the trick then ends, or the routine ends at that moment when I could get more out of this. So get rid of that altogether. What else can I do with the sugar? Well, sugar cube. Well, change it back again. Okay, let's change it back. So you change it to sugar cube, which gets an amazing moment. The moment your hand opens, people are like, what? It's amazing. And of course, when you change it back, that's impossible. You know, I felt it. It was hard. Okay, so we're now left with sugar, a torn up wrapper. It's a no-brainer. Let's put it back in. So I started putting it back in. And the end part of the restore, originally, I just restored it back to the packet and gave it away. But then I thought, well, how can I improve this more? What can I do to extend this even further? Well, what about if we open the wrapper and then when it was restored, there was a bit missing and I couldn't find the bit and, oh, there it was. And it matches amazingly. So well, the very first one was like, look, I've done it and I've matched the two. And that was good, but it was showing off and I didn't want to show off. So I thought, rather than showing off, what about if I forgot a piece? So I'd casually drop a bit on there or just forget about it and then restore the whole thing and just hold it up. There we are, all restored. Oh, there's a bit missing. There it is, silly me. Look, it would have matched perfectly. There it is. Put it on the table, let them keep it and then walk away. So that was the way it all evolved. So yeah, think of a routine and then think, oh, well, if you want to make a routine, think of a trick and then think, right, what has a similar effect to it? So something like hydrostatic pints and drinks. We sell hydrostatic drinks or glasses. And you think, well, what could you link that with? And you think, right, what is evolved around that? Liquid, glasses, etc. Well, you need something to put under the glass. So I'm a bit of paper. What about if you use like a newspaper and then you could do a drink in the news or maybe a torn sword? So all of a sudden you've got this routine now where you've got maybe a newspaper. Okay, and you show the newspaper and you open it up and then you you pour your liquid into it and then you open up, you show it's empty and you pour it back, okay, and you put it down, you tore up the newspaper, you restore the newspaper, you put the newspaper down, you pick up the glass, you pour the liquid into the glass, you turn it upside down, you put the newspaper off, and you know, you've got all these things you can do with it. You can link things together. So a trick it's okay on its own, but if you can link it together, it's more organic. It's just, it flows into it and you're becoming so much more than a trickster. You're becoming an artist. You're becoming somebody who performs a routine. And that is what I think worked really well for me. And that's the way I kind of think these things up. So, yeah.
And how long would that whole process take? Is it
kind of... usually organic. I mean, you start off with, let's say, the sugar routine. You know, I first learned to master the first part on its own. Once I master that, not just for me performing, I'd go out and perform it and I'd judge what the reactions were like. And if the reactions were good, then I'd extend that. But if I did it and the reactions weren't great, that one would go aside, move on to something else. So I did the first part. First part works great. Right, great. And then we move on to the next part, the sugar part. So I learned that at home. I'd master it at home, get it all right. I put my marbles in my jar. And when I could master it perfectly, right, I went out there and I tried it. And if it worked well on that point, I'll carry on doing it and I'll evolve it further. So the whole thing, I mean, the sugar routine from first concept to the final one was probably about 6 months just working on it. But I mean, you could put it together faster.
So here's a question. You talk about you did the marble thing, which gets you technically muscle memories kicked in. You've got it down from a technical point of view. You then talk about working it in. One thing that I've seen with magicians is they're I don't want to say scared, but nervous about trying a new trick out in a live paid gigging situation.
Yeah.
Because what happens if it goes wrong? What happens if there's an unknown variable? But also I think that you don't get the same experience of whether the trick's going to fly for you or not by just doing it to your mates.
Yeah.
How do you then go to work it in? You've got your marble thing down. How then do you get the balls to then go and put something new in that you've never done before?
In a rather unorthodox way.
Okay.
Right. So don't get me wrong. Once you've been out gigging, you've done a few hundred or a few thousand gigs, you don't worry about this kind of thing. You know what works. You know, you can work it straight in. I could probably take a trick from here tonight, work it for a few hours and go out and perform it. I wouldn't recommend it unless you're very competent. And I'd work it. It wouldn't be brilliant when I work it, but it'd be good and I wouldn't flash or anything. But yeah, I wouldn't worry about it. But in the early days, yeah, you're terrified. You know, I remember my first ever watch steal. I mean, I must have held someone's wrist 20 times attempting to do it and then just chicken out last minute. And the very first time I did it, I remember exactly where I was. I was in a Cafe Uno in Bath, overlooking the Roman baths there. And I had the wrist in my hand. I thought, shall I go for it? And I did it. And I couldn't believe I actually got away with it. It was like, I almost gave away that I'd stolen it by my reaction. And afterwards, I finally, my magician friends, I did it, you know, but those are the early days. Mm-hmm. So how to get around to it? So yeah, I had a rather unorthodox way. So once I'd mastered the muscle memory, which is really important because when nerves kick in, your muscle memory will go. So there is a certain amount of practice you have to do before you go out just to make sure that you can do it. So practice in front of a mirror. Don't practice too much in front of a mirror because you get used to seeing yourself. So then practice also in front of a video camera, which is easy nowadays. Not back in our day, you just have to hire a video camera at 80 quid a time. Then do something really weird. Go up to a wall, go right up to a wall, like this, about that far away, okay, and practice it in front of a wall, because believe me, it will throw you off completely. There's something about it, something about the sound reverberating back if you talk, because you've got to talk while doing it, something about the pressure you feel from the wall. It's amazing, but it really puts you off. So master it in front of a wall. Now, I'm not recommending people do this next step, but this is what I did and it worked really, really well. So one of my playgrounds was a nightclub at the end of my road. So it was run by a friend of mine, and me and an old Marine friend, Richie, used to hang around there pretty much 5 nights a week. And, you know, I'd help you on the bar sometimes if you were short staffed and do a glass collecting. So I knew the area really, really well. But what I tend to do, I was a bit of a drinker back in the time, so I just left the Marines. I would get a little bit drunk. Okay. And then I'd perform what I wanted to perform to somebody else who was drunk, somebody usually that I knew in there, because as I was drunk, it's, oh, it doesn't really matter, you know, he's a friend of mine, he's seen loads of tricks, and if it doesn't work, it's not the end of the world. So I would practice that, and then if it worked, I'd do it a few more times. And then once I could completely do it, I'm going to step back a step. Sorry. I would do it while sober to someone who was a little bit drunk, right? So yeah, so I'll be sober, pick someone who's drunk, do a little bit to them, right? When I could master that, I'd then have a little bit to drink myself and go and do it a little bit drunk to somebody that's drunk. And once I could do that drunk to somebody who's drunk, I find somebody who's sober and do it on them when I'm a little drunk. Now, that's the tricky part. So when you've had a few drinks and you're standing there like that and you're trying to do it, I mean, I'm quite a good drunk anyway. I'm not talking paralytic. I'm just talking, you know, 5 pints kind of thing. But if I could do that trick perfectly while drunk to someone who was sober, I knew I could get paid for that thing. So then I would put it into my working act, or I'd take it down to a residency if I wasn't getting paid, and I'd try it out a little bit there first when it didn't really matter. You've not got some high class, you know, booker overlooking you mess up a trick. So those are my kind of methods. It's really unorthodox. So I wouldn't recommend it. And we are talking 20 years ago now, but it worked for me. You know, it worked.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. So everyone watching this, go and get pissed and do magic. That's the best.
Yeah. Well, sort of sober. Do it to people. get your partner drunk and then do it to them drunk.
So you're right. So you're at the top of your game. You're in the top 10, 15 magicians in the whole of the UK. It's fair to say I'm not going to say you've mastered business, because no one ever masters it, but you know a lot about business. You know a lot about magic. You are not worried about the gigs coming in or the work coming in. And then you decide to change industries. Now, you decide to go from being a professional magician at the top of their game to running a magic shop. And I've told people on this channel before, I would never open up a dealership ever. I just think it's insane that, because it's such a niche thing. Where did that come from? Because I remember before Prop Dog, you were making a name for yourself selling Bonsalopes and Ring Flight Revolution. I'm pretty sure from memory that was pre-Prop Dog. Yes. I might be wrong, but yeah. I remember because you were doing lectures as well, weren't you? And the Sugar Routine were in the lectures along with Ring Flight Revolution. Bonsalopes. Everybody was buying Bonsalopes because it was the only, well, they still are, you know, it's the only envelopes that you really should do. So my question is, why did you move from there? Top of your game, you could have carried on doing what you were doing and, you know, retired a very happy man in many, many years time, and to go to do Prop Dog. Where did that come from? Why did you risk everything?
Because I'm an idiot. No. I'm earning less a month now than I used to get for one single gig. Yeah, that's how much, because there's not money. People think I'm rolling in it. I'm driving around in fancy cars and I'm running in it. I was doing magic, but not doing this. So there are so many factors into why I did it. Loads and loads. Right. First of all, when you say I'm at the top of my game, I was there. You've got to remember, this is kind of 15 years ago now, okay? And 15 years ago, there were far few professional working magicians out there. You know what it's like. Mm-hmm. It was so much easier to get work. Once the internet took over, YouTube took over, Facebook took over, David Blaine was on TV, all of a sudden, everyone wanted to be a magician. And you've got that stage now where, as opposed to being, you know, let's say, I mean, yes, there's 15, 20 top people out there, but there's probably about 50 people you could find on the internet at the time in the country that you could choose through to work for your gig. Nowadays, there's probably 300 or 400. Okay, so One of the reasons, not the main reason, but one of the many small reasons, is the market started to become flooded. And there were people out there with absolutely amazing websites, and they looked phenomenal, and they were crap. I mean, I wouldn't hire them for my worst gig ever. But you don't know that till you hire them. So you look on there, you think, that guy looks amazing. I'll hire him. You get to the party, and he does a terrible job. He's awful. He's got no communication skills. He doesn't make anyone laugh, and the booker goes, God, sod hiring a bloody magician, I'm not going to do that. And so that was one of my little things. I thought, well, this is getting flooding the market. I was getting outpriced by people who I knew were absolutely crap at magic, and that started to really piss me off. And I thought, well, now I don't want to keep completing with these. You know, I've put the best show reel I can get, and I've got a pretty good website, and yeah, my business marketing good, and I'm still getting paid, but I'm competing now with these guys. You know, somebody's saying, well, hang on, so-and-so is going out for half your price. What makes him, what makes you so much better than him? Or, well, you know, you're a little bit cheaper than him, but I wanted somewhere better, so I'm going to go with him. But hang on, you know, he's the same one who just quoted like half my price to the other client, kind of thing. You know, it's an awkward market. And that was one of the very small reasons. The next thing, probably the biggest reason of all, is I fell out of love with it. It's be careful what you wish for. You know, the kid in the candy shop, kid in the candy shop. 10 minutes later, he's feeling sick, he's thrown up. You know, there's too much of a good thing. I used to love magic. I used to love that reaction and that kind of drug you got, that you know, that clap from the audience where when you leave the room. And I love all that. I still do kind of love it now, but I lost a little bit of interest in that. It was like, right, okay, I get up in the morning, where to now? Right, I'm off to Swansea today. Right, get in the car, you know, leave home at 8 o'clock in the morning, go to Swansea. Right, where now? Oh, I've got another gig in Suffolk. Oh, bloody hell. Zigzag, cross country, go do a gig in Suffolk, get back at 11 o'clock. Right, okay, what's on tomorrow? Oh, look, tomorrow I'm in Liverpool. A nice 6-hour drive to Liverpool. And it was just a job. And the reaction started to lose their impact. And it was like, right, okay, oh, I've got to go. I've got to be everyone's best friend again. Off we go again. You know, it took a good 10 years to get there, but that started to become the attitude. And it's like, right, where's the challenge? You know, I'm a driven person. You know, I once trained for the Olympics at decathlon. I once was a Marine. I once trained to be the best highball springboard diver in the country. And I'd always had a goal to go to. Where's my goal now? Well, I'm at the top of the game here, and I've got loads of money coming out. I'm driving a Porsche, and I've paid off my mortgage, and, you know, this is great, but I'm miserable. I need more. You know, where's the next step for this? And I didn't really know where I was going to go. And I just went for about 2 years of feeling really stale. Like, get up, let's go and do it again. And never having a weekend off, missing friends' weddings because somebody had booked a year in advance or whatever. I thought something's got to change. Now, the other thing I loved doing was creating. I'd always loved building things and making things. And I'd already built my ring flight by that point. And I remember going to Blackpool and showing someone the ring flight I've made from this key, you know, and somebody said, that's amazing. Can you make me one? I'm like, well, I can. It took about 5 or 6 hours to make. I'll pay for it. Okay, so I made one and they showed somebody else and I made a few more. And I ended up zigzagging to gigs via car breakers yards to pick up old keys and then take them home and refurbish them. And I was really enjoying that process of creating and making them. And then selling them before knowing it, I saw like 300 or 400 of them from home. I thought, wow, you know, I'm making good money from this, doing what I love, and I don't need to do as many gigs. Maybe I can take a few less gigs, just work on the higher paid ones and do some of this, and I'll still get good money coming in. And then more people asked me if I could provide them with bonslopes. And at the time, I was making bonslopes by hand, and I was ironing old envelopes open, and I made a few for some people, and I thought there's got to be a better way, and eventually found a way to produce the bonslopes. And then it just kind of, people suggested to me, can you make me something like your ring flight, but like this? And I'd do that. And I was really enjoying this process. And it was like, wow, I feel like I'm energized again. I'm really passionate. And I couldn't wait to get home from my gig, go back in my workshop to make something. And that's kind of what started PropBlog. You know, I started to spend more and more time making things and taking less gigs on because I was making stuff. And eventually I thought, well, where did my future lie? You know, I'm kind of 42, 43 at that point. I was just turning 40 about this point and thinking, well, I've got a shelf life as a magician. I don't want to be a 50 or 60 year old magician struggling to get a booking because they're booking all the younger cool ones. So where's the retirement plan from this? Yes, I'm earning money. I could put money away in a pension, but I don't want to give up work at 55, 60. I want to be working until I'm 70, 80. And I want to have like a nice, something to leave behind, if you like. So I took the decision to start prop dog, really. And then within about a year, I was making so much stuff for people and custom props for people, which I was loving. I thought, I need to get myself a little unit. And if I'm going to get a unit, why not put a shop in it as well? I didn't want a physical walk-in shop. I wanted a workshop with a shop attached to it where people aren't going to walk past the high street and come in and say, show us a trick, mister. And yeah, that's where it all kind of started. So I took the bullet and thought, well, if it doesn't work, I can still gig. And I was still gigging for the first couple of years just to pay myself. So I wasn't paying myself for the first, I think, 5 years before I took a wage from PropBlog. So I was still gigging to do that. And then I started to take a small wage. And that's where we are now. And I love what I do. And it's not about the money. I had the money and it didn't make me happy. You know, I was earning well over 100 grand a year as a magician. And I was stale. I was bored. I was just miserable. And now I pay myself 700 quid a month and I've never been happier. I love my little empire. But it's a struggle. It's a constant struggle. And, you know, I don't know where we're going to be in the future, but I love what I'm doing at the moment.
One thing that I've noticed with you, and I want to talk more about Prop Dog in a minute, but you seem to have this innate ability of making tough decisions. You know, you talked about how you decided to become a full-time magician, then you decided, well, I'm gonna do this, and you just do it. And a lot of people procrastinate. You know, I've met people that I'm looking for the right time to become a close-up magician. I want to go full-time. And I spoke to them about this 10 years ago and they still haven't bitten that bullet. Have you got any advice on that decision-making process and kind of the mindset you have to kind of go through if you're struggling to decide whether to, let's say, for example, become a full-time magician or, you know what I mean?
It's really, really difficult. I mean, I've made a lot of difficult decisions, you know, everything from joining the Marines to, you know, to going full time. But I've also been very lucky in that when I left the Marines, part of my journey, when I said I was in hospital, learning magic and deciding to be a professional, I ended up being medically discharged from the Marines with that. So I had a bit of a pension coming in, and that pension still helps me survive today on the low wage I take myself. But it did also mean there was a bit of a backup plan. I could just about afford to pay rent and to eat if I was to leave and it didn't work with a pension. So I was quite lucky then. And I also had a bit of a seamless transition and I ended up being outperforming while I was still in the Marines, being paid by the Marines. So I was actually gigging. So by the time I left, it was almost a seamless transition. We were already doing a couple of gigs a week. So that was fairly easy. The decision to start the shop, again, it was, I had the backup that I could still perform if it failed.
Yeah,
you just got to be prepared to lose something and step out of your comfort zone. I mean, both moves at the time. I'm a single man now, you know. I've had my relationships, but I've never been married, never had kids. So I don't have those responsibilities, which are really tough. So if you want to make a move, let's say from your current job to being a full-time professional, first of all, make sure you've got enough gigs coming in. So you can still work your normal job and go and gig. You know, spend more time learning the business side, get yourself really established so that you're struggling to get to work because you've got so many gigs going on. And then when you've got your gigs coming on, then you can say, right, how much did I earn? Don't just do this in the summer because you pass the summer fine, but then you get to the winter. After December, you may be really, really quiet from January through to March or April. You may have virtually no work and you can't survive. So if you've got yourself really busy and you can survive that period and know that you've got enough money coming in maybe November, December to last a quiet period, then you know you're good enough to give it a go and hopefully COVID doesn't hit just as you do this. So yeah, you just got to make sure you've got a backup in some way. The other thing is if somebody dies in your family and you get an inheritance and you've got money in the bank, or if you win some money on the lottery, or if you've got a good savings bank or someone's willing to invest the money up, keep that money in the bank, work out a budget of what you can survive on for that year, and then you know, put that away and think, right, this is my backup, don't touch it unless I absolutely have to. And even if you're successful performing 3 months, still don't touch that money. That's your backup should it suddenly fail, should something go wrong. So yeah, it's difficult, but sometimes you just got to bite the bullet and say go for it, but make sure you've got a backup plan, something you know, to work by. I mean, I was lucky when I left the Marines, you know, I didn't have any backup plan. I could kill people or save them, that was it, or I could do athletics. So I was lucky, I had no backup plan after magic. So yeah,
that's awesome advice, that really is. Now let's talk about Prop Dog. You got the unit which you're standing in right now. When did you make the decision to start stocking sort of the traditional dealer items? Because when Prop Dog first started, it was all your own stuff, but obviously now I'm looking at the shelves behind you and I know obviously Prop Dog, you actually don't just stock Murphy's stuff, but you've got a big range of Penguin an illusionist and Theory 11. You know, most other dealers don't do that, which is really smart, in my opinion, because people in the UK especially can now get this stuff without having to pay a fortune in import duty.
Yeah, unfortunately, things like the Theory 11, Penguin, Illusionist, we can't get everything on their list. A lot of stuff they can't afford a wholesale, as we can't with our stuff. But yeah, so when I was just making keys and bonds, loops, and a few other bits and bobs, I decided to try and find some other things I can come, I can upsell with this. This is long before Murphy. So I went to a few of the Chinese sites and bought some Chinese coins in, a few of things that weren't rip-off items from China, but just stuff that I could get imported cheap, like a cup and a ball or something that I could upsell, or squeakers, stuff like that, purse frames. And that was just, if someone's going to order a ring fight, they may as well add a few other things if they wanted to. And I kind of learned then that, you know, a bit of an upsell will really help on things, especially when it comes to running the shop. So when I come to the shop, if they're going to come to us and buy a ring flight, what else can we sell them that be worth it, you know, to help us? And we're in London. We have extortionate rates and business rates and rent and everything is extortionate. So we need to make more money than we could just, you know, we never survive off just our own products. We need to sell a few other bits and bobs. So at that point there, I applied to Murphy's and Murphy's vetted me apparently and considered me okay to be a supplier. And they started sending stuff in. And then, you know, if they're coming to us to buy the ring flights, they could buy other Murphy stuff. And then I thought, well, I hated the idea of ordering something from a shop and then waiting for 3 weeks for it to come in and realizing that all they're doing is drop shipping. So I thought, right, well, we're going to do everything against that. I'm going to stock up the shop in full. So every single penny that shop made for the first 5 years went into restocking stuff. I didn't take a single penny. I just wanted to have stock in the shop. So when someone ordered, I could send it off straight away. I learned that from Davenport's. So Davenport's in the early years, you could phone them up. If it was before 3 o'clock, they'd get something in the post that day, you'd have it the next morning. And I loved that. And you couldn't get that with other places. So I decided that that's where PopDog was going to go. So I wanted to stock as much as I could to help it out. And then realizing that people were complaining about having to pay import duties and stuff from Theory 11 and Penguin, why not get that stuff in, pay the import duty our side so that it's easier and they can get it the next day. And that kind of worked as well. But it's a curse as well. So, I mean, you've worked in a magic shop, you've worked with a magic, you know what it's like on there. There is so little profit on any kind of magic from Murphy's. It's unreal. I mean, we're talking less than 10% profit. So if you buy an item off us for 30 quid, we'll make £3 profit, which seems ridiculous. But when you consider that it's all imported from Murphy's, which means you've got to pay shipping fees, which is 300 or 400 quid a time from America. You then have to pay your import duty. You then get the terrible exchange rate you pay getting it here. Then you're going to do your 5% back in reward points because everyone else is doing it. You've got to compete. Then you've got your free shipping on top of that. And then you put on top of the cost of running a walk-in shop, you work out it's 10% profit. Now, when you think about somebody comes in the shop and they spend 5 hours in the shop walking around the shop and you're serving them and you're paying somebody £5, £10 an hour, that's £50 in wages serving someone. And they walk out with a pack of cards worth £10 that you make a pound profit on.
Yeah,
that's not a good business idea. Or you consider that we spend so much time every day packing up the orders, the cost in wages just packing up the orders barely makes a profit on it. But having all this stuff means they'll come to us and chances are they're going to buy one of our products on it at the same time. When they buy one of our products, that's when you make the money. So we're in this awkward situation where if we just sold our own stuff, we wouldn't get as many customers, but we'd make a lot of profit. But if we sell other stuff as well, we'll get more customers, we'll make far less profit. So this kind of catch-22 situation. So yeah, I just wanted to run a shop, a good clean shop that had everything on the website that was in stock. And at first, if we ran out, we'd disable it from the website, but apparently that kills our Google search engine. So we just put it as out of stock on the website. And more importantly, we'll just be honest with customers. And it's worked for us. We're doing well. We're staying alive. We're not making loads of money. You know, we barely make enough to stay open and still make a profit. But I don't need the money. I can survive on what I've got. My little pension, my little bit from the company. I live a nice little life. I don't have children and lots of outgoings, you know, and I'm happy. I'm happier now than when I was earning all that money as a performer. And I still get to perform. I still get to perform in the shop. And if I want to do a gig, I can still go out and do a gig. And I can be more choosy over gigs. So yeah, that's how PropDog started.
But one thing that I want to pick up on, and one of the reasons that I absolutely love PropDog, and as you know, I order from you guys an awful lot. One of the reasons I love you guys is because you are completely and totally honest. Now, regular viewers of this channel will know that I've been on a mission for the last 6 months. Yeah, right?
Yeah.
About just how shit There are so many shit products these days. Somebody can have a brain fart in the morning, create a product, have it out as a download in the afternoon. You know, most of the stuff that's getting released now is some stupid gimmick with no routine, no live performance, no nothing. And what I love about you guys is you call these people out as well. You're the only dealer that I know that actually is prepared to come and say, well, this is bollocks. You don't buy this. You know, as of the time of filming, you did this yesterday. You put a trailer up for another brother's release and you were like, look, this is a complete fabrication. And I've seen you do it over and over again. Some people would say that's not the best business move, but I respect the hell out of you for doing that, Dave. I really do.
I mean, we've shot ourselves in the foot many times over, and the amount of hate mail we've had for it, but then the amount of love we've had for it far outweighs the hate. So yeah, we think very much alike. I said to you earlier, just before we started the show, I've only just discovered that you're on the trailers as well, which is brilliant, somebody else doing them. And I was talking to Alex and saying to Alex, I did my first podcast only 8 years ago. And one of the things I raved about on that, or ranted about on that, was the fact that I'm fed up with people releasing crap with amazing trailers. And it's still going on now, 8-9 years later, it's still going on. So yeah, the honesty part, I mean, like your Egyptian Ink review is one of the ones I watched yesterday, loved it. And again, with my Egyptian Ink review, it was like, here's my review for Egyptian Inks. Crush it up, throw it in the bin, right on camera. That's my review, I hope you liked it. And that was the way I felt about it. And that was one of the first really hardcore ones I did, and I got a ton of hate from it, but then the love I got back was great. So yeah, the honesty. As I said, I'm not in this for the money. If I was in it for the money, I'd be like, guys, this is fantastic. You know, check out Summit. It's the best thing since sliced bread. It's the trick of the year, Ekaterina. It's an amazing trick. It's a pile of pants. It really is a pile of pants. And I'm happy to say that. Now, yes, Murphy's hate me with a passion, okay? We've had many a fallout of Murphy's. I've had many dealers phone up Murphy's and ask them to stop dealing with me because they don't like the fact I do this. We sell a fraction of what I would sell. I could sit there. I could get 100 of these in. I could sing its praises. It's the best thing since sliced bread. You guys will buy 100 of it. I'll be like, yes, all that money. Look at that. Those guys will open it and go, what the hell? That was dishonest on the trail. I can't do it. That's not what's going on. Chuff Diddy's, you bought the secret now. I'm all right. Yeah, so I won't do that. I said since day one, I do not want a single one of our customers to have buyer's remorse. This is too small a community. If they buy something from us and I say it's brilliant and they open it and it's crap, they've lost all respect for me and anything I had to say. Yeah. Okay, so I want to be honest with you guys and just say it's good. It's bad. We'll lose sales from it, but at the end of the day, we'll lose respect and we'll get a following, and people will be around following us, hopefully for years to come, as long as we keep this honesty up. The same as if you buy something and it's utterly crap, you send it back to us. As long as you've got the packaging, send it back to us, I will refund you because it's my bad. I shouldn't have had that on the website, and therefore I'm going to put a warning on it. Maybe I didn't look at it properly. I saw the same trailer as you, and I'll do that. That backfires on us a lot because the amount of people that will try and pull a fast one with us. I bought this from you, it's crap, can return it. You didn't even buy it from us. You didn't know, you've never bought anything from us. Or you send them something, they open, they show you like Mental Dice. Somebody recently from New Zealand has sent us a video saying, oh, I opened Mental Dice and there's no Mental Dice, there's only the charger in it. Well, I know fully, we checked that beforehand. It was in there, we sent it off. But they're relying on us being the nice guys saying, don't worry, we'll send you a new one. Because quite often, if there's something wrong with the product, we'll just send you a new one. No questions asked, send you a new one. If you're abroad, it's too difficult to send it back. Don't worry about it, just keep it, it's fine. It's a love-hate relationship with other dealers and distributors, but you know, the amount of kudos and the love we get, I mean, just look at the comments from the trailer from Summit. I mean, people love us, we get so much love. The amount of gifts people send us every week, and we get bouquets of hampers, you know, chocolate, sweets, bottles of whiskey, wine sent to us. People just love what we do and want to be a part of the proper community because we're friends that are giving you honest advice, real honest advice, not like some people would say honest advice. We're giving you honest advice. We are telling you, save your money, don't buy it, it's shit. And you know, people are so grateful for that, they come back. And
it shows in your reviews as well, because I remember reading on the internet somewhere, never trust a dealer that does a review. I absolutely trust ProbDog when they do a review. Even like I just talked to you off camera, I was watching last week's Facebook Live. And you were talking about the music box, and you were like, well, this is way too overpriced. It should be this much. It should be a lot cheaper because of this. And oh, I know how much this is worth. And there's a and Bitcoin. And even when you've got a product that you quite like the Bitcoin thing, you were like, well, this is a bit dishonest because of this, but it's still decent. You're just totally honest about it all. It's just amazing to see.
The music box pissed me off because I know they're £4.50 each for the deluxe version with the box. And to charge 80 odd quid for that, I mean, I know Murphy's got to take their cut, but that's pushing it too far for what you get. It really is. And that's why I wanted to kind of call it out a little bit. I shouldn't have done really mentioned prices, but I had to. I mean, yeah, you buy a prop for £4.50, you make your own little bit of paper with it, whatever. The whole thing would have cost them less than £6 to produce. And then for have it on sale at 80 quid. That's one of my issues with something like Murphy's. We are still a cottage industry. I've always said this from day one. There shouldn't really be a wholesaler in a cottage industry. You know, we don't have 2 billion people out there to sell things to. We've got a handful of people. Now, by having cottage industry, it means everything gets priced up an extra tier. You know, the manufacturer's got to make the money. The inventor's got to make the money. Murphy's got to make the money, and then the dealer's got to make the money. Back in the old day, it was like someone comes up with an idea, sells it to the dealer will sell it out to somebody, and you do it that way, and everyone will make more money, and you'll go to this shop for these tricks, this shop for this trick, this shop for this trick. Nowadays, you go to the shops, and because everyone's selling the automatic, everyone's got the automatic Murphy's feed that just shows you everything that's on Murphy's website for sale on their site. So everyone's got 22,000 products on there instantly, and that, it kills it all. I mean, we don't do the thing, by the way. You don't do the automated thing. We choose. But yeah, because of that, everything's more expensive, far more expensive than it should have been. What should have happened is with Music Box is they should have created it and either sell it themselves or go directly to the dealers. That way, the whole thing would have been maybe £50 instead of £80. Still a lot of money. With us, it's like hydrostatic glasses. You know, we sell a hydrostatic, let's say the pint, for example, £24.99. Okay, we make about £8 profit of that. If we sold that through Murphy's, you're looking at £60. Yeah, you're not going to pay £60. It shouldn't be like that. So, yeah, I forgot where this I go off on tangent. So, we're back. Yeah, so honest reviews, what we're talking about, the music. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Well, here's a question. What, I mean, you bring out your own products and you are very selective of what you bring out. You only bring you've talked to me in the past off camera about how you have 10 ideas and you've been 9 of them because you don't want to be What as an industry, you know, you've been in this industry your whole life, you're uniquely positioned to answer this question. What as an industry should we be doing? Because it's getting worse and worse. 8 years ago, you had a rant on Richard's podcast. Mm-hmm. It's not got better in this last 8 years. It's got worse. And every single day, you see more and more shit coming out. Mm-hmm. That's overpriced crap. But the problem is, new people that are coming into magic, that's what they're buying, because that's the thing with the flashy trailer. They're buying the Colorful, they're buying the Summit, they're buying the Triple Helix or whatever it may be. They're not getting any instructions on how to perform it. It is literally, this is the trick, this is how it works, not even a live performance. And so back in the day when you and I learned magic from the Darrells and the Pat Pages and the Michael Amars, and you learned a routine because they only put stuff out when they worked it for years and years and years. So you knew that it was perfect. You don't get that anymore, which is why, you know, you talked earlier on in the interview about substandard magicians. It's because they're not getting the same teaching that magicians did back in the day, because they're buying this flash in the pan stuff. As a dealer, what can we do in this industry to try and turn this around and move in the other direction?
This is where it's so frustrating, okay? So, yes, back in the day, somebody would have a routine, they were doing their act, and they would at some point decide, right, I'm going to market this routine, I've been performing it, I've put years of my life into this, I almost feel like I'm wasting it just doing it myself. You know, I've got so much to give somebody else, I'm going to sell this to a dealer, or put it on the open, or sell it to the lay people, and they can share in my act, you know, which has got 5-10 years of work experience. You can show them every nuance, every little thing that goes on with it, and they just know it works. Nowadays, it's like, right, I need some money, what should I do? Let's invent a new trick. Okay, go and pick something up. Right, okay, I'll go for an old book, there's an old trick. Right, I'll put my twist on that, boom, package it, nice trailer, off we go selling it. And that's what it's become. It shouldn't be about that. It shouldn't be about how to make money from magic. It should be about how do we enhance our art, our craft? How do we make this whole thing better, not worse like it is now? And I kind of blame Murphy's again on this, not just Murphy's, but other dealers, but Murphy's don't have a filter. They don't, when somebody comes in with a trick, they don't turn around and say, well, do you know what? It's just a pen and this, and it doesn't really do that. It's not really that workable, really. Sorry, guys, you have to improve it before we can take it on. No, Murphy's don't do that. They go, yeah, okay, how much you want for it? How much? Yeah, okay, well, we can probably knock off a load of those. Now, it's not a very good trailer. Either film a better trailer or we'll film a trailer for you, and then we'll sell it from then. So all of a sudden, you've got this great trailer, shit trick, goes out, loads of hype, usually on pre-sale, so that people buy it before they read the reviews. Why pre-sale anything? One of my biggest gripes, never pre-sale an item. Pre-sale it so that they can sell them all before the reviews come out, and then reviews come out, it's crap, it suddenly dies off a month later, no one's interested in buying it whatsoever, it's past its time. Murphy's have made their money, the dealers made their money, the manufacturer made their money, everyone's happy, right, that was successful, what's next? It shouldn't be like that. So yeah, how do you stop it? Filters. I mean, people like us who are going to stand up and say, do you know what, we won't stack that. We won't stop it. Stock it. And the reason we won't stock it is because they're lying to you. It's one of those ideas that I throw away every day because I have ideas like this and think, do you know what? Forget it. You know, I've got too much self-respect and pride to release that. I don't want my name going downhill like Sands Mines, like the other brothers are rapidly doing with their products. I mean, things like their little debut thing, you know, you're paying through the roof for something ridiculously small that's already been forgotten about, you know, a month or two later. Have some kind of self-respect in what you release. Don't just release things for the money. Leave it to the people who have been out there working. I don't know if the other brothers ever worked a gig in their life, but they certainly don't look as though they do. They're just like two people who didn't get into making performing, so thought, well, we'll make some stuff. There's easy money in this. Boom. Get rid of those people. If you don't stock their stuff, no one's going to buy it. Or if you show what the trailer's really showing, then hopefully, I mean, we must have stopped probably 100 people buying that now. And that's what more dealers need to do. They need to have a filter. It'll be better for all of us. We'll all do better in the long run, have more respect, better magicians, and better quality stuff in the long run for it.
Right, because if dealers were completely honest, like you were.
Yeah.
Murphy's, at the end of the day, the reason they push out any old shit is because they have a bottom line. They're a business. They want to make money. And they know they put a product out, they're going to make X amount from it.
Yeah.
If they're starting to produce products that nobody is buying because the word is out there that, like, oh, this is terrible, this is terrible, this is terrible, then perhaps they'll hire a guy who sits in Murphy's, an experienced guy who sits in Murphy's that goes, no, 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 no. And I don't know why they haven't. I don't know why they haven't got somebody in a quality control department somewhere, an experienced magician who can go, shit, shit, shit. Or maybe not even shit, go, this is, right, no, we're not taking this. This is what you need to work on. Go back, fix these things, then come back and see me again.
They kind of did a bit with Tim Trono, a little bit. He was a little bit like that, so that has helped. Well, but
Tim okay, but, now.
The thing is, excuse me, Murphy's have it easy, okay? Murphy's are not on the front line. We're on the front line. When the customer goes and buys that, takes it home and goes, what the hell? I'm never going back to Prop Dog again. Why would I go to Prop Dog? They said it was good in the trailer. Oh, sod that. I'm sorry, I can't respect that. Or they're not on the one on the end of the phone saying, excuse me, I want to return this. This is not what it said in the trailer. This is terrible. And we're the ones who have to give the refunds and deal with all the stuff. Not Murphy's. They're sitting there happy. They've got no customer interface other than Amazon that they're not officially selling on. But yeah, they've got no customer interface. It's us dealers who've got to take the stick from people. And we've got to hold our heads, you know, down in shame because we end up selling something that was absolutely shit that we missed on a trailer. So yeah.
But there's so much stuff that comes out, it's almost impossible to vet every product. You refresh Murphy's and every day there's like 20 new things coming out. It'd be a full-time, you'd have to hire a full-time member of staff just to vet every single trick that comes out through Murphy's.
Well, we almost have to hire a full-time member of staff just to deal with the problems from the tricks from Murphy's anyway, whether it's missing codes, missing products within it, broken products, or just terrible quality. We're sending a box back today. It's actually the box of computer sending on, right? So the box down there, you can't see it. The box is that tall, by that wide, by that wide, okay? And that is all the returns we're sending back to Murphy's because they're defunct or absolutely appalling in quality that no one has opened up and gone, yeah, that's all right, and put it back in. We've got products that don't even have labels. They're just in blank boxes. How are we meant to know what it is? You know, no one puts a what it is on the front of it or any kind of product code. It's just a blank box. And yeah, there's no filter on it. And we're the ones who've got to put up with this. And if all dealers turn around and said, I'm sorry, no more, then Murphy's wouldn't be getting this stuff because no one's buying it. If every dealer said, you know what, we're not going to stock this, Murphy's are now stuck with 2,000-3,000 of these that they can't sell, they're going to think twice about next time what they produce a product and take it out there. So that's what it needs.
You know what? I completely agree with you. Let me ask you one more question. You deal with a lot of other companies as well. We talk about how you stock stuff from Illusionist and Penguin and Theory 11. Penguin, Tim Trono's now at Penguin.
Yeah.
I don't know, but from the outside looking in, it seems that Penguin, a lot of the stuff that they bring out in-house with P3 seems to be very good quality. Although they stock all of the Murphy's stuff, they do seem to be doing a better job as far as I can see.
Penguin and Vanishing Ink, brilliant. Brilliant business models. Funny enough, both of them based within about a mile of Murphy's, which is very handy for that. Very, very smart. And they both release good content and Vanishing more than Penguin vet their stuff a bit too much. There's a few things, quite a few things of Penguin stock that need to be vetted a bit more. But in general, the levels are 80-90% of everything on Penguin are really good, and like 90-100% of everything on Vanishing Ink are good of their own products, of course. Not talking about the Murphy stuff, their own products. So yeah, they are doing it right, absolutely. And we aspire to be a fraction of what they are in the future. But again, they don't give the bad reviews like we do, so maybe that's where we're going wrong.
Well, let me ask you one more question. Couple more questions.
More than one, if you want.
Oh, good. Thank you. Let's very quickly talk about the Facebook Live.
Yes.
Of course, I want everybody who's watching this channel right now, when you've finished watching this video, don't watch my stuff on a Friday. Forget about the rants. It's not important. Go and watch the Propped Up Facebook Live. It is my favorite thing to watch on the internet. Man, it's great. It so is. It's like...
Not always.
It's like Top Gear for magicians, I think is the best way to describe it. Yeah. I remember when me and Dave used to do the Wizard Product Review for World Magic Shop back in the day. And this is just like a million times better than that. You guys just have an absolute blast.
Wow, Wizard Product Review is brilliant. We all love it. I mean, you got tens of thousands, 30, 40, 50,000 subscribers on that. Your views get...
We were doing it when nobody... It wasn't a thing. I think it was the first YouTube show, you know. Yeah. And that's all Dave Penn being very, very clever, you know, but...
The first 6 or 7 years, everyone kept saying, you've got to do a review show. And we can't do one. You've got the Wizard Product Review. If we do it, we're just copying them. And that was always a thing. You've got to do a review show. No. So we just started doing the independent reviews. I mean, if you've never seen them, just go to our YouTube page, for example, and go for the shop videos, because they're... Before the Facebook Lives, there was all our reviews, independent reviews. And sometimes we would spend 2 or 3 days setting up one single review, because it's not just a review. There's usually something really funny, like our Cube to Candy review. Did you ever see that one?
Yes.
I'm just holding a Rubik's Cube saying, we're going to talk about Cube to Candy, but first of all, here's my version of it. Hold a Rubik's Cube there, and for 5 minutes, Skittles fall out all over the thing. Just things like that take 2 or 3 days to set up, and then we go on a bit of a review. And that was our way of doing our own show that was different to Wizard Product Review, because I just didn't want to copy you guys or be in here like you. I had no interest in that. So we started doing all those, and they're great, but it took so much time and staff wages and everything else we need to do. We thought, you know, we've got to spend less time, and I'd love to be spending 3 days on every review, but you just can't do that. It's just not enough profit in what we do to be able to pay the wages to do that. So we ended up doing smaller, shorter reviews. And now you've got Jason and Alex do a lot of short standalone reviews. And then we do the Prop Dog Lives. Now the Prop Dog Live came about as a one-off kind of show. We'll experiment, see what it's like. And we've just us with a little iPhone and just having a bit of a laugh. And people liked it because it was just a hangout with friends. It wasn't a review show. It wasn't like, right, today we're going to review this, this, and this, and this is all the show, and it's not pre-recorded. There's interaction. So whereas Wizard Product Review is great, but people say, okay, that's great. I wish I could ask him if it did this or did that. Well, on our show, they can. So sometimes we'll have no products at all, and other times we'll have a load of products. But more important is a hangout with friends. So the idea was, We'll get together. Anyone can ask any questions. We'll read all the comments, nearly every single comment that comes up, we read out. And then if you guys want to look at something in the shop, if you want us to go and open that DVD over there, we'll go and open it up for you and have a look inside. We'll see what the gimmick's like. Sometimes we can show you, sometimes we can't. If you want to ask our advice on, you've got a gig coming up and you want some advice for it, maybe you're nervous, you want to know how to overcome that, you can ask us. If we show you a trick like that and you say, is it practical? We can say, well, I haven't opened it yet. Hang on a minute. Let's open it up. Oh, God, no. Yeah, forget that one. And straight away, you're done without having to buy it still. And that was what it evolved around to. And it becomes so popular. I mean, some of our hits had 8,000 views before we even left the shop. Most of them, you know, about 1,300 to 2,000. But yeah, it started to come back. It was the whole love thing. As I said, people were showering us with gifts. People just kept buying us things and just sending me a random bottle of whiskey in the post. Just thank you for being so great on your live shows. And we love what you do for the magic community. And I was like, we've got to carry this on. We've got to keep going. So then eventually I got the little system I got now with a proper camera, proper microphone and all the setup now. And we're doing it a bit more professionally. But we still don't plan anything. And I think that's one of the keys to it. We don't come there with a whole list of things, rehearse what we're going to say, what's going to happen, or we go by the script. I mean, most of the time, 5 minutes before, right, okay, grab some stuff to talk about, let's just go and hang out. I think the other day we had not a single thing to talk about, and we had nearly two hours we did just chatting with people, and not a single product talked about. And you know, it's great, and people give us so much kudos for it. So
it is fantastic. I've got to say, one of the funniest things I've ever seen is when you guys put out your second review of CTG. Had to take it, and the way that you guys handled it, and it was just the most sarcastic, hilarious thing I've ever seen. I just honestly almost wet myself watching it. It's just funny the way you guys have got such a great class.
We're very lucky, and Alex and Jason feed off each other very, very well as well. So, but unfortunately, Jason's leaving us actually. He's going to be going into a teaching job. So I've just found out a couple of days ago, Jason's unfortunately going to go and be a full-time teacher. He's a qualified teacher. It's just job security, especially in this market at the moment with everything going on. So, yeah, he will be unfortunately leaving us. So that, some of that magic between the two will go. But I'm sure if everything goes well after COVID and we survive through it all, scary times, then we'll probably end up getting somebody else in, or we'll see how it goes. But, yeah. Don't know what's happening with the proper future. It's especially with
Brexit. What I was going to ask you, what's next? Because obviously we've had a year of lockdown. I can only assume that that's kind of affected things to a certain degree. Yeah. I mean, obviously the hobbyists, I imagine, have still been buying stuff. But I mean, what is next? I mean, I don't want to see Prop Dog going anywhere. You have built up something so special here.
Yeah.
That is beloved by so many people in the community.
It's so unbelievably difficult at the moment. I don't know where the future of it is going. We're having loads of conversations about this at the moment. So, first of all, Jason going, yeah, that's going to be an issue, but we can get somebody else in. But with Brexit gone on, things are changing in July with these new rules that we have to register for VAT in a separate country outside of the UK, in the EU. We'll have to charge VAT for every single customer for their country rate. So Italy, maybe, I don't know what, 21% VAT in Italy. France might be 19%. Turkey would be 17%. We've got to charge individual VAT on all of those. If it goes above, I think it's £155 or something, then there's a whole new VAT accounting system. But there's so much work that's going to go in to shipping to Europe now that the accounting bill is going to be through the roof. We're probably not going to make enough money from selling to Brexit to do that, unless somebody changes. There are a lot of people going up in arms about this, so hopefully things might change before then. But that's one scary point. Then we've got things like our rent is due for, or at least is due for renewal, in a year and a half's time. Now, I've got to make a decision, are we staying or are we going? Now, because of COVID and all the struggles going through COVID, we're barely staying open. So we don't know if we're going to make enough money to survive. We're getting better every month. We're getting better until COVID hit and we're going down. I don't know if we can even afford to stay here. There's so little profit in what we're doing. And being in London is the most expensive thing you can possibly imagine to run a shop in London when there's so little profit. I mean, you take your electricity bill at home and times it by about 5, and that's what we're paying as a shop. You know, we pay £200 or £300 a month on internet, £200 or £300 a month on water, £200 or £300 a month on sewage, not to mention the terrorism insurance we have to have because we're near to Heathrow, and the public liability insurance and the staff liability insurance, and all these things add up. And you think, how much longer can we survive? If after COVID things don't recover, we can't afford to stay open here. We're going to have to move or do something. So I still want to have a walking shop. I love having a walking shop. I love what we do. I'd love to be able to stay here and make enough money. But the other thing is, well, at some point I am going to need more money for myself. I can't keep surviving on what I'm doing. Our house is falling apart. I need a new boiler. I need to have my, you know, my kitchen sorted out, all kinds of things. So I've got to think to the future. And the future is either we move to become internet only, which I really don't want to do, and when we move somewhere outside the M25, or we move somewhere obscure like Wales or East Sussex, where the rent is ridiculously cheap, and maybe we can have another internet shop with everything here and keep on going as we're going, and a brick and mortar, or do we say, right, get rid of all Murphy's, let's just survive on prop dog stuff. The big boys like Illusionist and Theory 11, they're making a fortune. They're only selling their own stuff. Smaller unit, you know, maybe buy a house with a farm attached to it. So there's all these things that I've got to figure out where we're going in the future. I'd love just to stay here, Karen, as we're going, and make more money and be able to survive. Every year they put our rent up here, and there's going to become a level where it's just not cost effective to keep being here. I mean, if you knew how much money it costs to run this, everything we do here, all the things we make, all the custom products we build, all the Murphy stuff, all our own products, all that money, all the profit goes to just paying to have the shop here and to pay the rent. We don't make any money out of it. You know, we don't make a profit. I think last year we made something like £10,000 profit for a shop that's got £500,000 turnover that's been open for 8 years. You know, we've got to move on, and we've got to make it more of a business in order to keep going. I don't want to. I want to keep on going with my friends out there coming to me to buy stuff. But I can't. At some point, I have to be a business and say, right, you can't keep running a shop where you are. Something's going to happen. So, yeah, I don't know what the future holds. Every day is just...
I listened to all of those options that you outlined. None of them was give up and quit.
Oh, no. I've gone too far.
You like I do, that isn't even an option.
I don't want to go back just to performing. I love what I do here more than I love performing beforehand, but I can still perform here. I love magic, and I can still be involved in magic. I can make stuff for people, which I love doing, and then perform those. And see people performing what I've made gives me just as much of a buzz as performing to somebody. So yeah, I've gone too far and built too much of a business and too many friends and too many followers and a community, a proper community out there, to give it all up. You know, I'm going to fight to the end. I'm a fighter, you know, I'm ex-Marine. I'm going to fight. I'm going to give it a go right to the end till I die. Yes. Yeah. Proper of my life.
Way to go. What can people do that are watching this to support you?
I
genuinely want to know, like, what we can do, because although I know the industry, you know, that I've worked with dealers for the last 15 years, and I know more about that side than most magicians because of my previous dealings with David Penn and Will Magic Shop. I kind of know, but I didn't even realize, you know, you're talking about, well, it's 10% profit and blah, blah, blah. I didn't even realize that.
I
mean, what can we do that are watching this channel to support you? Is it buy your products that you produce yourself?
Right. So the place has to be more cost effective to run, for first of all, because, you know, we've got 5 members of staff here, and staff is quite expensive. So if you're going to come in the shop as a walking customer, respect the fact that we are paying an hourly wage to the person that we make low profit. So if you're going to come in and spend 5 hours in the shop, by all means, look around and every now and again ask a question. But if you come in the shop, said, can I see that? Can you dem that for me? Can I see that? And 5 hours later, walk out with 10 pence worth of a profit for us, or, you know, you buy one DVD and you walk out. Or worst case scenario, you walk out with a list of everything you looked at and played at, and then go online and buy them cheap off eBay or Amazon. Be respectful of that. Now, one of the things we shoot ourselves in the legs a bit in that we'll quite often interact with customers, and we want people in and we want to have a little chat. When someone phones up for an order, if you don't have to phone up, please order online, because inevitably we're the friendly shop. And if you're going to chat to us, we're going to chat back to you. We want to be friendly with you. But that friendliness can be taken the wrong way, and we end up starting conversation, gets onto their gig, and then they start telling us everything they do in the gig, and then asking for advice. And before you know it, you've got half an hour, 40 minutes on the phone. Oh, by the way, yeah, I need to order a couple of decks of cards. And again, we've lost any profit we made in that order through the time we spent on the phone. The same with questions and emails. Now, we're more than happy to help people out, but save that for the live. Come on the live when we've got specific time to help you out, because I'd say probably 10% of all our emails are, can you advise on this? You know, can you give me a list of tricks for a show I've got coming up? You know, do your homework beforehand. Can you advise us? Can you help us with that? So we get loads of those emails, and that can sometimes be almost a full-time member of staff just dealing with people. To us, you know, that's $3,000, $4,000 profit a month gone just for that. Little things like that. Don't come on the shop, find the products you want, watch our reviews, and then go and find it at the cheapest possible place you can buy. Because there are people out there, bedroom warriors, who run the shop from the bedroom, don't hold any stock, and they're just drop shipping from Murphy's. They're not VAT registered. They're going to undercut some price. So if you come in, I wouldn't say abstract effects, but let's say you want to go with the Xena ESP testing cards. Quite a nice little product, right? Rather than saying, oh, Pop, I've just done a good review of these last week, and they're £23, but on eBay, I'm getting for £21.50. Bah, go to eBay and do that. That will help, you know, us. People who, if you want to one day walk into a brick and mortar magic shop and have a look around stuff, support those brick and mortar shops, support the Alakazam, support the magic boxes in Newcastle, support the Dominic's and the Merchant of Magic down in Portsmouth, support those walk-in shops, because one day they're going to disappear if people keep buying off internet-only shops. I mean, there are other shops out there that I know will go through everything we do and undercut us. They'll watch if we put a newsletter out with four products on, and then going to go and undercut those four products while the duration of that newsletter is being sent out. You know, help us out. Sometimes we have to charge that few pence extra just because we're a walk-in shop, and we have the expenses that all those bedroom warriors and the other shops don't have. So yeah, it's if you want to help us out, be willing to pay £1, maybe £2 extra sometimes on a product. Don't come in the shop with a shopping list. Look at all the stuff, go home and buy it cheap online elsewhere, and then try and be aware of our time that you use when you come into not just our shop, but any walk-in shop. If you go see Pete Nardi and Alakazam, okay, don't spend an hour asking them questions or just chat, hanging out. I would say with Dave, but Dave's gone, isn't he? But don't just hang out with Pete just for an hour, just chatting to Pete, because Pete will chat to you. He's a nice guy, but that's Pete's time. Pete should be answering the phone, doing other things. Just be aware of people's time. It is money. Time is money. And as much as I want to be, you know, a friendly hobby business, we are still a business. So yeah, that helps.
So true. And you know, one other reason to support Prop Dog especially, and I totally agree with Alakazam as well, but one thing that you do that I've never seen any other dealer do is if you get a product in that you think has potential, but you think it's flawed in some way, you'll fix it.
Oh yeah.
At no charge.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, let's take Wonder Pop, for example.
Yeah.
You know, Wonder Pop is a great idea. It's a really great idea. But if you actually buy it from anywhere else, it'll fall apart within 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But you completely, and I don't think you charge you any extra for this, but you completely redesign the gimmick and you fix it to make sure that it's all working perfectly. And I've had my Wonder Pop off you for ages, and it's absolutely brilliant. And that's an example of something that you do that I've never seen another dealer do.
This is one of those cases of people have created a gimmick and it's a brilliant idea, but they don't have the making knowledge, the creator knowledge to make it properly. They've made one, they've gone out, tested it. It works great, great reactions, lovely little prop. I guarantee you the ones they made, they broke a few times. They had to keep replacing it and get sorted out. Oh, what the hell? We'll send it out. At that point, they should have stopped and said, right, let's figure out why this is going wrong. And the fix would have been simple. You know, for example, with Wonder Pop, the problem is they thought, right, we need to seal this soapy liquid in. Now, soapy liquid will penetrate into anything. That's what it's designed to do. It'll seep into things. So we need to seal it. We'll use a sealant. We'll use like a bathroom sealant or something like that. And a bathroom sealant is fine if it's sticking to the right material. But then the material in the Wonder Pop is it's a PTFE material. It's basically a lubricated plastic. It's an oily plastic that, although you don't see it, does leach out like an oil. You can't feel it. It's very, very minute. But what happens is that reacts with the sealant and it doesn't stick. So the moment you squeeze or move it, it just unsticks and it all leaks out. The outside label, they used paper label with something, again, that's designed to penetrate and peel. So as soon as you've got a paper label on it and you get a little bit of the bubble liquid spit onto it, it just starts to peel off. Little things like that you should think about. They stuck the little bubble thing in with the thing you blow the little bubble loop with. They stick that in with the same sealant. Of course, the moment it gets wet, it unsticks. All you had to do was do some bit of research and find out what chemicals react with each other. And you had to find out that what they're using reacts in the wrong way with this material. All you needed was a simple hot glue gun, okay, and do it that way. But then when we take them apart, they've got a little acrylic disc, they put them in and they seal it up and it comes apart. We take them back out. But what we've realized recently is, well, you've got the little bit of acrylic disc in, they're not even bothered peeling the protective blue film off the acrylic disc. So this ceiling is not actually sticking to the disc, it's sticking to the ceiling bit on it. It's little things that they're just not paying attention to what they're doing. So we said, right, great product, we like it, we want to stock it, but we can't sell this, therefore we'll take it, we'll revamp it and send it out. And we make probably 5 pence profit of each one. But it's not about that. It's about the fact that if someone wants it, they're going to come to us and they think Top Dog, good name, they're doing the right thing, and it reinforces their love of us. And in return, that will pay back in the long run by them buying our own products, knowing that they're well made. So yeah, we do that a lot.
So you've got a lot of experience making gimmicks. If somebody wanted to have a product bought out through Prop Dog, I know that you're very picky. We talked about Match of the Day and you know, which I think is a great product. How can people approach you about a product? Is that something
they do all the time? Yeah. The main issue I have with this is people have ideas and they come to you and says, here's my idea, make it. But they don't realize that, yes, you've got an idea, but you've not got a method. You don't know how to do this. It's like someone coming to me and saying, right, okay, I want you to build me a chop cup, but inside that chop cup, I want a very thin glass. It's exactly the same shape as a chop cup that fits on top of it. And then I want you to do something inside so it sticks to that glass. And I'm like, okay, how does it work? What's the method behind it? Well, I don't know. Well, how does it stick to the glass? Well, I don't know, but that's what I want you to invent for me. It's like, well, if that's the case, I'll just go and invent, you know, a million tricks, you know? It's like saying, oh, I want a Ferrari to drive down the road, a red Ferrari, and I want it to suddenly turn into a bus. Can you make that for me? Well, how's it going to be done? Well, you're the magician. You figure it out. It doesn't work like that, you know? If you're doing that, that's my time. I've then got to find a way to do that. Now, it's not just a case of, that's the idea, there it is. I've got to figure out, that could take me 3 or 4 months. I could be working 10 hours a day for the next 3 months to figure out how to do that, if I can ever do it at all. Are you going to pay for that time? I don't think so. And this is what we get an awful lot. There are occasions, like I'm working with Andy Nyman's son, Preston, on something at the moment. He has an idea, didn't know how to do it, but I love the idea. So I'm figuring out a way to do it. And we put probably 50 or 60 hours into it so far, but I'm not charging him for that because when he releases it, he's going to release it through us. And I think it's worth it because I think it's a really, really good effect. And I think we will be able to find a way to do it, just a bit more experimenting. But again, we probably spent £400 or £500 so far on silicones and molding materials to try and make it. So yeah, it's difficult. If you come to us with a method, figure out not just a trick idea, because anyone can do that. I can sit there all day long and list you 1,000 tricks to invent. But without a method, they're not a trick. They're just an idea. So have an idea and a method of how to do it. Even if you don't know exactly, you know, the ins and outs of it, we can figure that out, the mechanics of it. As long as you know how it's going to work in your head, give that to us and then we can make it. And then if it's something we're interested in taking on, we'll offer you, you know, do you want to release it through us or do you want to release this through Murphy's? If you want to release it through Murphy's, you're not going to want 500 or 1,000. You're going to want 3,000 or 4,000 if it's a good product. So therefore, why don't we make the prototype and we give you all the designs and plans and you get that mass produced somewhere else where you're going to make it a lot cheaper in bulk and then sell it to Murphy's. Or if you want it just for yourself, come to us with an idea and we'll make it and just charge whatever it takes. So yeah, it's different ways of doing it. If you want to release it for us, we'll obviously do a deal on the manufacturing process and how it comes, but as long as you're covering our time and a profit on that. So yeah, first of all, make sure you have a method and it works and it's not crap, basically. Yeah,
that's perfect. That's absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
You know what, Dave, this has been one of my favorite interviews. I wanted to speak to you very early on in this channel's life, because you know how much I respect the hell out of what you've achieved with Prop Dog, you as a performer. I was buying stuff off you. I think I was one of the first people to buy a ring flag. And it's still in my act today. The sugar routine's in my act today. What you do in this community is absolutely brilliant. And
thank you.
Such a breath of fresh air. You really are. And I want every single person watching this to support Dave. My viewing figures, by the way, I get the majority of people that watch this are from America. So people in America, they can order from Prop Dog as well, right?
Well, absolutely. And do you know what? We've got a huge customer base in America. So if I go to America and try and order something, most shops in America won't ship outside America, which is crazy. So people come to us all the time. Do you ship to America? I'm like, dude, yeah. I'll probably say 40% of our customer base is in America. And what they don't realize is the exchange rate is really, really good for America. So we're the ones who suffer the exchange rate. If we buy something from America, we pay a fortune. If they buy it from us, they're getting a really good deal on the exchange rate. Plus, you don't pay VAT. Now, VAT, let's say, I've had to change this on a website. On a website, they always give you the price. It says what it is with VAT. And underneath it says EX VAT, excluding VAT. The American people say, why do I have to pay this top price and the price underneath on top? why is that extra price there? I'm like, it's not an extra price, it's excluding. Oh, we just changed the wording now. So saying a non-UK price. So basically, if you buy it from us, you're paying the price without the VAT. So a £100 product, you're getting for £83. Now, yes, you'll have to pay import duty when it arrives in America, but the import duty in America, the level is something like $200. So if your item is over $200, you'll get charged VAT on it or customs tax in America. But under $200, you don't get paid tax. You know, we can put a product on, cut the value, £150 order, put it on there, go across, you won't have to pay anything. So not only are you getting it at a cheaper exchange rate, you're not paying the price of the tax you would pay in America. And we're free shipping to America over £50, over anywhere in the world, over £50. So we've got a load of customers who have switched onto this who are now buying from us or buying from customers in the UK because it's cheaper in the UK than it is in the States. And we can often get stuff faster to you in the States than you can from somewhere else. So we've had customers in California or New York buy for us, for example, who said they've got stuff faster from us than they have from Chicago, for example, or from Washington. So yeah, we've got a lot of customers in the US. It only takes 5 days, sometimes a little bit more. We can send it by a 2-day courier, even a 1-day courier if you want to. But do check it out, because quite often it works out a lot cheaper than you think. And yes, we do ship to the US.
That is amazing. Yeah. Dave, it has been a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much.
It's lovely to speak to you again, mate. It's good to see you. And thank you for your continuing support of PropTech and for what you do to the community. You know, your YouTube views are an absolute eye-opener. They're breathtaking. I you did a load of stuff on it, but I didn't realize all your playlists were there on there with everything you do, from the interviews to the reviews, just to the honest trailers. And I'm going to be spending a lot of time on your channel now watching that. So thank you too for everything you do for us.
Thank you.
One of the few gents out there, again, like us, do speak up and call it out when it needs to be called out. So thank you for that.
Appreciate it, man. Thank you so much. Right, everybody, support PropDog. Thanks very much for watching the interview. I'll be back tomorrow with a review show or a magic rant. I'll see you then. Thanks very much. Bye, everyone.
Cheers, guys. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast.
Magic, magic.
Be
magic.
Sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel.
Magic TV.
Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV, or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.